Morning, everyone. Welcome to Labor, Workplace, and Regulated Industries. I call the meeting to order. Representative Sundin, would you be so willing as to move approval of the minutes for March 5th? Representative Sundin moves approval of minutes for March 5th, 2014. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. The minutes are approved for March 5th, 2014. Welcome, Representative Lilly, to the committee here. And I'm going to move that House File 2285, the bill that we have before, that your bill be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance and Veteran Affairs. And do you also have an amendment?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We have an amendment.
I'll move that amendment to put the bill in the shape that you would like it. Anything you want to say about the amendment, or does it kind of speak for itself?
Mr. Chair and members, good morning. Thank you for having us. The amendment to the bill is it was Mr. Hubinger's idea, and I think it's a great one. It's essentially that the governor would notify the legislature within 30 days, I believe, if they were to make a wage change in their commissioners.
Very good. Well, I'll move that amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. The bill is now in the form that you want it to be. Representative Lilly, if you want to present the bill, that'd be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good morning. Pretty impressive, right on time. Good job for an East Sider. Mr. Chair, there's a committee of subcommittee of employee relations, which we're we used to have Mr. Benson on, but he's I guess he
Brett Benson.
We asked him to be off, but we asked him to be on. We got a different Benson now, a Senator Benson, so he's sort of there. So anyways, this bill essentially ratifies 8 contracts. And then three of our folks that are in control of our pensions gives them a bump that matches some of what our commissioners are at. But I'm going to pass to Mr. Hubinger, and he can go through the bill and explain it. And I don't know if you know Mr. Hubinger. He's really really knows these things and is great to work with.
Well, welcome, Mr. Hubinger. If you want to walk through the bill, that'd be great.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission and the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. As Representative Lilly indicated, this bill would ratify 8 labor contracts with state employees in the executive branch. It covers 3 contracts for AFSCME, a contract for the professional employees represented by MAPE, by supervisors for Middle Management Association, the engineers, the special teachers, and a 12-13 contract for the Law Enforcement Association. The 14-15 contracts that make up the bulk of the bill fall into a pattern that provides 3% across-the-board increases for employees effective July 1st of 2013 and another 3% across-the-board effective July 1st of 2014. For the half of state employees who are not at the top of their salary ranges, they are eligible for step increases, also known as performance-based increases, that range between 2.75% and 3.5%. The other common variable across all the contracts is that beginning on January 1st of 2015, employees will begin paying 5% of the premium for their health insurance. Employees will continue to pay the 15% towards family coverage that they pay now. These contracts are for the 14-15 biennium. Bill also ratifies 3 compensation plans for employees who are unrepresented: the managerial plan that covers deputy and assistant commissioners and bureau chiefs. It also ratifies a compensation plan for unrepresented employees in the commissioner's plan and for 45 unclassified employees in the Office of Higher Education. Those 3 plans have similar benefit increases as the labor contracts. As Representative Lilly indicated, the bill would also ratify 3 salary increases for the heads of the state pension funds, MSRS, PERA, and TRA. It provides a 5% increase in salary on January 1st of 2014 and another 5% on January of 2015. Those increases are comparable to what agency heads appointed by the governor have received. In your packet, there's a summary. There's a spreadsheet at the end that shows the fiscal impact, which probably be considered by the next committee.
Thank you, Mr. Hubinger. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, I'm going to open it up to questions, comments from legislators in the committee, and go from there. Representative Benson.
Thank you. Representative Lilly and Mr. Hubinger, nice to have you both here. You've probably figured I'd have some questions. Can Mr. Hubinger maybe give us some idea? I think for the record it's important to understand what 5% actually means on the individual plan in terms of approximate dollar figure for the individual that will have to now pay towards their health insurance.
Mr. Hubinger?
Mr. Chair and Representative Benson. If I have monthly premiums, the annual premium for a single employee is about $7,000 roughly, and for family coverage it's around $15,000. So beginning January 1st, the employee will be paying 5% of that premium.
Approximately,
Representative Benson?
About $30 a month. Does that sound about right?
That sounds
right. Mr. Hubinger?
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Benson?
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The agreements in question here. No, these are new. These aren't an additional addition to the ones that we ratified or were ratified and passed into law last year. This would be a new group whose contracts just came up, and essentially the employee labor group, employee relations group, has just recently met, approved these, and you're bringing these to the legislature. How do these compare again? Could you give us an idea, Mr. Hubinger, of the contracts that we approved in 2013? Are they similar? To help with that, quite often in these labor agreements, they're called Me Too, and so what we find is a follow-on in terms of we get what you got, and does that follow a pattern?
Mr. Hubinger?
Mr. Chair and Representative Benson, the contracts for the 12-13 biennium that were ratified in the 13 session were for the last biennium, and they provided across the board, only in the second year, provided step increases in both years. Those had an impact on that biennium of about 1.6%. The contracts that are being ratified here are for the 14-15 biennium, provide 3% across the board increases in each year and steps in each year, have an impact of about 4.6% on this biennium.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Benson?
For Mr. Lilly, then, who's on the board. I know that, having been a member of that committee, the commission, that you're really not given a lot of details in terms of the negotiation. Those are kept kind of secret until that gets to you. But what rationale were given to you to see such an exponential jump in the terms of these agreements as they relate to the agreements just passed? Would it have had anything to do with the large tax increases that we saw this last year and the additional revenue? Or can you give us some idea of, we went from 1.6 to the amount that we just heard. How did we justify that large amount?
Representative Lilly or Mr. Hubinger, whoever wants to tackle it, I guess.
Mr. Chair and Representative Benson, the information that the subcommittee was given by Minnesota Management and Budget, which negotiated the contracts, was that this was the amount, these increases were those that were necessary to reach a settlement with the employees. The objective is to be able to retain and attract a quality workforce to carry out the work of the state.
Okay. No further.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Representative O'Driscoll?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lilly and Mr. Hubinger, just a couple of questions. As I've been looking over the paperwork the last couple of days in preparation for today's meeting, one thing that I am questioning and just would like a little bit of explanation and reassurance on, right now healthcare costs are sort of in flux because of some of the change over, with the Affordable Care Act and MinSure and some of the other kinds of things, and that seems to be something that the state of Minnesota has its eye on quite regularly these days. or I should say citizens in the state of Minnesota have their eyes on that the legislature has done. How are we budgeting for or backing on some of the health care costs? I see that we do have the contribution from family and something that has been important to a lot of members in the legislature, some contribution from singles on that, which I think is something that bodes well for the overall package. But beyond that, the 95% and the 85%, how are we protecting ourselves as the state, and how are we working with employees on that? Can you talk a little bit more about what your anticipated rates might be, or just talk about that, since that's a kind of a corner of the tent that can flap quite regularly in the wind because it's an unknown, and how we might have backed ourselves on that.
Mr. Schumacher?
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, the state is self-insured, so it has a strong financial interest in trying to maintain and manage the health insurance costs for its employees. They have numerous programs in place that promote wellness. The plans with the carriers that provide the insurance have strong incentives to try to promote wellness and for employees seeking health care. Premiums have increased on average about 4% over the last several years, and so that's one indication that they are trying to manage those costs.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Huebinger, this may be an MMB type question. I don't know if we have a representative from MMB today with us who could maybe answer this if it's a little outside of your purview, but what day of the year do we usually get, or what time of the year do we usually get the notices of changes in premiums and things from our providers, and what do we get the most recent one? And because you said we had kind of an average of 4%, but what has the last one been, and or when's that, what's our next one if we've received a notice of what those premiums might go to?
Mr. Schumacher?
Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll, premiums increased 4.4% for calendar year 14 and are projected by MMB to increase 3.8% for calendar year 2015. Those numbers are based on an analysis of the claims from the previous calendar year.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Huebinger. Thank you, Representative Lilly.
Representative Benson, follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, members, it's important to remember that 3 years ago, 2 years ago, I guess, we did have a couple of bills that would have asked that individuals pay towards their health insurance premium. But also with that, of course, was coupled a much smaller increase in wages. I think it's important to understand that with this agreement, it would sound like that we're moving in the right direction and requiring individuals to be part of, assuming some responsibility for their health insurance, which is a good thing because now they actually begin to see that there's a real cost to it. But it's always been embedded in their salary and have been a part of the compensation package. Which it's important, I think, to understand is that they have been well compensated in this package to take care of paying for that $30 per month charge. So when we think at least that the observation would be, well, they're taking some responsibility for it, management in effect have said, you're going to have to pay a little bit more, but we're going to pay you to pay for it. So we shouldn't be deluded as such to believe that, you know, the employee is suddenly paying into this health insurance plan but not getting compensated for it. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, the chair renews his motion that House File 2285 be re-referred to the committee on as amended to the Committee on State Government Finance and Veteran Affairs. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is re-referred.
Thank you,
Representative Lilly. Thank you, Mr. Huebinger, for your input. Next bill up we have before us is House File 2366. I'll move that House File 2366 be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs and Economic Development, Finance, and Policy. Welcome, Representative Rosenthal, to the Labor Committee. Great to see you this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
And it appears you have one author's amendment. Is that correct?
Actually, we have two.
You have two author's amendments. Okay. Well, let's take the first one first. I'm not sure if we have the second one in our packet. We have the A1 amendment, and you say there's an A2 amendment as well?
There is, Mr. Chair. You should have a copy. It's very brief.
Our staff is going to make copies, apparently, of the second one. So let's go ahead.
Mr. Chair, is that the A1 amendment? Mr. Chair?
We have the A1 amendment, but not the A2.
Correct.
So we're going to make copies of the A2 right now.
Mr. Chair, just a question on the A2 amendment.
I'm sorry.
Did that make the 24-hour deadline? We just didn't get it in our packets, or why was that not included in folks' packets?
I do not know, to be honest with you.
So we don't have any assurance whether that met the committee's rules for the deadline?
I don't have any assurance. You have it?
Yeah, maybe some members have it, but others don't, so I'm just asking the question.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, is my I was told that it was delivered to the committee. It's a very short amendment. It could be done orally, I believe, if necessary.
Right. Well, we're going to move ahead with the A1 amendment, and then when they come down with the A2 amendment, if anybody has a problem with that, we can put that off to the, we won't take a look at that one. So with that, do you want to say anything about the A1 amendment before I move it, Representative Rosenthal? We'll put the bill in the order that you wanted, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, I'll move the A1 amendment to House Bill 2366. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. The bill's now in the shape that you want it. If the A2 amendment comes down, we'll have members look at it. If they're okay with it, we'll deal with it. If they want to not, then we won't. So that's kind of the lay of the land. But go ahead with the bill presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2366 basically extends unemployment benefits for victims of sexual assault or stalking. The current law covers domestic abuse. And at the chair's request, I'm going to remain brief and turn it over to my testifier, Carolyn Palmer, who is from Mincasa.
Welcome, Ms. Palmer. And if you'd identify yourself, please, and go ahead and give your presentation.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Johnson. Thank you, and thank you to the members of the committee. My name is Caroline Palmer. I'm the Law and Policy Manager at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. We are an advocacy program that represents advocacy programs all over the state. There are approximately 70 of them working in almost every county, so you probably have one in your community. I want to again thank Representative Rosenthal for bringing forth this bill. We really appreciate his support. And joining me today to answer any questions you might have are Kim Babine from the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development, as well as Meg Hobday from Hamline University. So if I can't answer the question, I will definitely be referring it to them. So I'm just going to provide a little bit of background. As you know, a person who quits a job or is discharged for misconduct is not eligible for unemployment insurance, but we do have some exceptions in the statute. Under the current Minnesota law, a person who quits or is terminated from a job due to domestic abuse may be eligible for unemployment insurance. This exception may also apply when there is an immediate family member of that employee who is a victim of domestic abuse. In reviewing the practices of other states, we've also found that some include sexual assault and stalking in the exceptions. Further, last year when the Violence Against Women Act was authorized in Congress, or reauthorized in Congress, they also have been continuing to expand protections for victims of sexual assault and stalking. So it's timely for us to be making these expansions in our own laws. So essentially what we're doing today is asking to add sexual assault and stalking to the law, and also we're making some other changes that I'd like to explain that come along with the amendment. But first I'd say that the reasons that somebody may need to quit a job because of sexual assault or stalking are many. There could be safety reasons. Maybe the victim survivor needs to leave the area immediately or needs to get a family member out of the area immediately. They may have medical and therapeutic needs as well that take up too much time for them to be able to work. If the immediate family member is a victim, then the employee may need to provide full-time care and support for that family member, particularly if it's a child who's been the victim. As you can imagine, any financial security that can come to a victim survivor in this situation is really important to support their healing process. I want to say that in preparing this bill today, we had significant assistance from DEED. We really appreciate their help. And we also have very helpful input from the Human Rights Committee and the Labor and Employment Law Section of the Minnesota State Bar Association. In addition to including sexual assault and stalking in the statute, you'll see that what we would like to do is remove the evidence list that currently exists in the statute that has to do with the types of evidence that you would bring forward to show whether or not there's been a domestic abuse claim. I want to really assure you that removing the list doesn't change anything about the application process or the way that DEED reviews the claims. Really what this came down to is that DEED told us that they felt it was time to treat these particular applications just like they would any other claim that would include sexual harassment, chemical dependency, medical needs, things like that. Really, what happened this in the past is that this evidence list was included because, unfortunately, there have been some suspicions about victims making false claims. We know that that is a very rare occurrence, but the list was included as some sort of fallback because there were those suspicions. And so it's really great for us to hear DEED saying, we really want to treat these claims the same way as all the other claims. We see this as real progress for supporting victim survivors. It also creates great consistency in the statute as well, because you'll see that really there's no other evidence list included except in that one particular section. Because it doesn't change the process, a victim can still send in evidence when they provide their application, either with their initial application or if they have an evidentiary hearing during an appeal. And in a way, the list that exists in the current statute is kind of misleading. Just because you provide that information, it doesn't mean that you actually are going to get your claim. DEED will still go through its process of reviewing it. You still need to show that there's a nexus between leaving the job and the existence of domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking. The standard of review is preponderance of the evidence, and the bill includes references to the relevant statutes for criminal sexual conduct and stalking. You'll see that the domestic abuse statute is already referenced. So there is some guidance for DEED and the unemployment insurance judges in determining whether or not the claim has been met. And really, this sort of an unemployment determination analysis is similar to what DEED already goes through when it's looking at other types of claims, too. And I just want to end by saying we're requesting this change to the statute not because there are so many cases. In fact, DEED tells us that there are very few cases made and claims made in a year. But for the handful of people who would benefit from this bill, access to unemployment insurance during a time of trauma could really prove to be a lifeline, a very important lifeline. Access to economic security is a means to safety, and a victim needs to be able to act proactively to protect themselves and their family. Unemployment insurance can provide that peace of mind while the victim attends to their personal or family needs. And I can say that many of these victims really do want to be in their jobs. They want to be working. They don't want to be in a position of having to leave their jobs because of this. So we hope it's an opportunity for them to get back on their feet. So I'm happy to answer any questions, and I also have Ms. Babine and Ms. Hodge, too, who can help me out.
Very good. And before we move to questions, let me ask in the audience, is there anyone who additionally wants to testify that's here? I don't see anybody. Okay. Before we get to questions from legislators, let's address the A2 amendment briefly. I'm going to go ahead and move the A2 amendment and then turn over to Representative O'Driscoll. Representative O'Driscoll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment appears to have made the committee deadline, but it was not in an email that members received. I'm just sharing this with our members that came out at 3:45 as far as amendments were concerned, but it was also not posted on the public website. And with the speed that bills seem to be moving through committees this year, I would ask for attention to detail so that we can have some more transparency with the public on these. This is clearly a technical correction, and we're not going to stand in the way of it, but I just want to just put that out as a word of caution for transparency for Minnesotans. Enough said.
Very good. We apologize for that, and your willingness to work with on it is appreciated. So thank you. So I'm going to go ahead and move the A2 amendment to put the bill in the shape that the author so desires. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. The A2 amendment is adopted. And we're going to move to questions from committee members. We'll start Representative Buglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief also. I just have one question, perhaps of Representative Rosenthal. The question regards the sworn statement that's in the bill. Could you tell me a little bit about the process on that? It's page 3, line 3-3 or 3-2. Sworn statement to who, and what's the process on that?
And to either Representative Rosenthal or Ms. Palmer, whoever wants to tackle that.
Representative Johnson, Representative Uglum, actually that particular line has been removed in the A1 amendment.
Okay.
So that's no longer there. We didn't think it was necessary. It was part of that whole evidence list that is included there, so that is now removed as well.
Representative Uglum.
So then the change or the chain of evidence that you talked about before, could you elaborate again a little bit on that?
Sure.
Ms. Palmer.
Representative Johnson, if you look at the first introduced version of the bill, you see starting at line 2.27, there's a number of different records you can provide, such as an order for protection, police report, things like that. And then we had added a sworn statement. What we learned from DEED is that you can submit any of this anyway when you put in your application. You can say, I had to quit for this reason, here's my police report, whatever it is. It's not necessary for it to be outlined in the statute. And when you look at some of the other sections at the top of the page about medical or chemical dependency, they don't have those same evidence lists. But people can also provide backup evidence, too.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. You know, I certainly am absolutely empathetic to the situation, especially being trained as a counselor and all of that in my past and working with people with that have been victims and so on. My question really is process, because I serve on the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Committee, and I only missed one meeting, but I understand that this did not come before them, which I find curious, at least when we're talking about process, that big step was really missed, because that really is should have been the first stop, really, because that's the advisory council made up of public and legislators and everyone trying to make the best policy that we possibly can. And so can you just speak to that as to how that process got missed and why that did happen? Because, you know, serving on that committee also, I'm very concerned that was missed.
Ms. Palmer?
Representative Johnson, Representative O'Neill, I'm going to ask Ms. Babine to come up here as well from DEED, but I'm also just going to add, because of timing, you know, we're not as familiar with the area of unemployment. We didn't actually realize that existed. So we brought this to DEED in probably late December, early January. If I understand correctly, your process is in the fall.
Yeah.
So some of it was timing, but I'm also going to have Ms. Babine come up and speak too.
Welcome, and if you want to identify yourself and respond to Representative O'Neill's inquiry.
Thank you, Chair. Members, my name is Kim Babine. I'm the Director of Government Affairs at DEED. So, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, you're absolutely right that this did not go through our normal Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council process. And for members who may not be familiar with that, the Department of Employment and Economic Development has this council. It's not in law. It's informal, it's informal such that it's not in law. It is a formal process. And it brings together labor and business and advocates and other folks and legislators who are interested in this topic, so that we can maintain the balance between in our unemployment insurance system, so that there's good policy that everyone can agree to. And we know that it's a real strength of Minnesota's unemployment insurance program. However, that is a process by which DEED goes through to help develop policy, so DEED knows what to where folks are in terms of what to support and move forward and what needs more time. That is that process. So there is a bill that is coming forward that will be introduced that has what was discussed at the council. The legislature is, you are your own body, both the House and the Senate, so you do not need to take only what comes through the council. So when you have policy that's before you, DEED remains neutral on the pieces that come through that aren't through the Advisory Council, but we don't oppose this policy, and we know that sometimes the process doesn't always work, that some people aren't aware of it, and it is if the legislature decides if it is in the best interest to move forward with it at a given time.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have kind of a funding question, I will disclose because Representative Nelson's to my immediate left, and he's real good about reminding us in government operations that we're not a fiscal committee, but I may not get a chance to ask this question, and I think it's an important one, so if you'll allow me just a little bit of latitude on that. Representative Rosenthal, the way that unemployment insurance works in the state of Minnesota is if an employer lays off an individual or a group of people, they're assessed a certain fee as a result of that to help offset those benefits. Would an employer be assessed a fee if they had an employee who terminated employment under the two proposed provisions that are here, or is that, are we making it a public policy, and therefore it would come out of the state's general fund to offset these benefits?
To Representative Rosenthal or Ms. Palmer, either one of you answer that?
Representative Johnson, Representative O'Driscoll, I think I can answer your question. I may ask Ms. Vivian back up if I can't get it entirely. But if I understand correctly, that the vast majority of these types of situations would result in a quit, so you're correct in that. And it should not be any change to the charge or change to the tax rate of the employer when the applicant quits, unless the applicant quits because of a good reason caused by the employer. In this case, it's not caused by the employer. So as I understand it, if it is a quit and benefits are paid to the applicant, the benefits are simply paid from the trust fund and not charged back to the individual employer.
We just get confirmation from Dita on that. As she had suggested that they're here, and maybe we can just get some additional insight.
Certainly.
On that. I don't want to put the employer in a situation that they aren't directly responsible for in respect for what we're trying to do here as well, just looking at that angle of it as well. So thank you.
Very good. Ms. Bavine, want to give it a shot?
Hi again, Kim Bavine from Deed. That is entirely correct on the trust fund. There's no impact to the general fund. Minnesota is an, I'm just going to make sure I see this. So an experience rated system. And so when when there would be layoffs or people are fired, then their experience rating would go up. But we are under the understanding that it would be a quit and not caused by the employer. So their experience rating would not be affected. Is that your understanding from? Okay.
Good. Seeing no further questions, the chair renews his motion that House.
I think we have one more testifier that would like to speak.
Oh, I'm sorry. Please come up and testify. There's three of them. I thought I asked and I didn't see any hands. But very good. Thank you for catching that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ben Gerber with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce.
I'm Jennifer Schaubach with the Minnesota AFL-CIO.
Gary Thaden with the Minnesota Mechanical Contractors Association, and all three of us serve on the Unemployment Advisory Council.
Very good. And do you have a unified position? Or
somewhat.
Yeah. So I think what you know, our concern was is the process, and you heard some of that. I think from my organization standpoint, we can't support it because we haven't been able to vet it through the process. Our main concern, which it sounds like Deed is confirming, and we just want to make sure that's the case, is that it would be a socialized cost within the trust fund. I think that's our concern. Whenever you have a quit that's not due to the or when it's not due to the employer, that those tend to be socialized. So we just wanted to confirm that.
And Mr. Chair, that's the reason that we like the Unemployment Advisory Council, is because we vet these things ahead of time and make sure that there's no unintended consequences. And so that's why we think it's an important process.
Very good.
And
Ms. Schaubach?
Our organization has taken a position in favor of it, but again, I think we would all agree that the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council is a great place to really sit down, and it's a great group of folks that really, really do look to make sure there aren't any unintended consequences. So we had spoken prior to this hearing and about making sure and going through that, and we're more than happy to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else who didn't testify that wanted to say anything?
May I make a
Representative O'Neill?
Thank you, Chair. And just to that point, I would just ask Deed, I think they're still here, that if in the future that this situation would arise again, I would really strongly suggest to Deed that they would direct them to the advisory committee, because as we just heard from every aspect, you know, of the advisory committee, it is a really important place to vet these things, and we can look at them thoroughly, and then we can actually come out and fully support them. But I would just really strongly recommend to Deed that they would please direct people to that proper board so that we can look at that.
Very good. I think your point is well taken. So again, the chair moves that House File 2366, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs and Economic Development, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor, as amended. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Rosenthal, Mr. Palmer, for your testimony today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Simonson. I think you can move your own bill. Representative Simonson moves that House File 2615 be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs and Economic Development, Finance, and Policy. And I believe you have your own amendment, A2 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I do have the A2 amendment that I'd like to move.
Very good. Representative Simonson moves the A2 amendment to put the bill in the form that he so desires. Any discussion on that? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Simonson, the bill is now in the shape that you so desire. And I know you have a few testifiers. Why don't you begin by presenting the bill as you wish, and then we'll move to the testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to keep my comments brief in order to respect the time of the testifiers, but I just want to make a couple of comments about this bill. This is a really exciting bill for me to carry. This broadband issue has become very interesting to me as we look at ways to expand opportunities across Minnesota, and I think that this particular hearing is going to generate a good discussion, and moving forward, we hope that we can come up with something that fits the needs of Minnesota. And matches at least somewhat with the needs of all of the interested parties. But the reason why I'm bringing this forward and the reason why I'm excited about this is that Minnesota has really fallen behind in technology a little bit. And this state has yet to make a really serious investment in broadband infrastructure. And the result is that as we are falling behind, the state currently ranks 23rd nationally. Now, you can say, well, that's middle of the pack, that's average, that's okay. But I think Minnesotans pride themselves on being leaders. And I think this is one area where we can make an investment and create some opportunities for new jobs, new growth, and as well as a progressive state of Minnesota. Businesses support this. General citizens support this. There's a tremendous buzz across the entire state about this particular issue. And the number one thing that I hear from most businesses that I talk to is that, you know, broadband, critical, good broadband is a need that they have. For a lot of the design work that's done in today's world, they need to communicate with their customers. And it's frustrating for them when they don't have the infrastructure to do that, because they really do want to be here in Minnesota and they want to have the tools available to them. So I won't belabor any more of the points. We can get into the structure of the bill later, but I want to turn it over to the first testifier, Mr. Chair.
Chairman Johnson, members of the committee, I'm Gary Evans, chairman of the board of the Greater Minnesota Partnership, and I want to talk to you today about the importance of broadband to Minnesota's competitiveness. In the context of this morning's discussion, I will be speaking as the former president and CEO of Hiawatha Broadband Communications, a small Winona company with a big reputation. HBC was funded by the founders of Fastenal Company, first as a not-for-profit education initiative known as LumenNet that began in 1994. Our partners were U.S. West and Sprint. In 1997, HBC became a for-profit company because the number two executive of U.S. West came to us and said, cities like Winona and other cities of the third class we're going to be overlooked in the broadband race because the big providers did not have improvements there as part of their strategic program. He felt that there would be a niche for a company like HBC. The Fastenal owners again stepped up, making an $8 million investment to create the new company and donating the 8 million shares of stock to Winona's not-for-profit community, most of them education institutions. HBC quickly became the preferred provider in Winona, where it enjoys 78% market share. The company has now grown into 16 southeastern Minnesota communities and is overwhelmed by the number of requests from communities in Minnesota to take a look at them as the site for a new network. HBC was the first company of its kind, a competitive entrant, to become profitable. In 2009, it was a chief advisor to the team that wrote the National Broadband Plan. In 2010, was honored at the National Press Club in Washington by the Benton Foundation as one of six best-in-class communications companies. In 2010, was featured in a two-hour CNN special, and in 2011, was the only Minnesota company named by the White House and the National Science Foundation as one of seven charter companies to form an initiative called U.S. Ignite. That initiative is designed to link up communities with gigabit-enabled networks and to use them to develop and trial 60 transformative applications in areas of strategic U.S. interest. I tell you these things not because I'm interested in bragging rights, but because other telecom companies will, as they have in the past, seek to impugn our reputation and decry the need for broadband improvements in Minnesota. And they may seek to confuse you with the definition of broadband and the terms unserved and underserved. The definitions can be a very confusing topic, and I would encourage you to do your own research because the things you are told may sound sensible but may not make sense. I want to tell you about what we have found in our development in southeastern Minnesota. Every community that we have built is larger today than it was when the network was built. And in two cases, that reversed six decades of population declines. And as I told you, we are overwhelmed with the number of opportunities that we hear about and are asked to look at. The fact is we need a dramatic step in Minnesota on the broadband front, in greater Minnesota in particular. We're not doing well, in my opinion. The U.S. isn't doing well either, and it's going to begin to hurt us in the area of economic competitiveness. The bill that we're talking about this morning will take a first dramatic step at making a huge difference. And so I would urge your support for it as I turn it over to my colleague Dan Dorman for a further explanation.
Thank you, Mr. Evans, for your testimony. Welcome again, Mr. Dorman, to the testifiers' tables. Good to see you. And identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Dan Dorman. I'm currently serving as the Executive Director of the Greater Minnesota Partnership, which is something that many of you may or may not have heard of. So we did distribute a packet of information, Mr. Chair, for you and the members. I'll just take a brief moment and describe a couple things. The first page of that just talks a little bit about our organization, where we came from, and why we formed. On the second page of that, you take a look and see who our our board of directors are. They are city officials, nonprofit officials, business officials, EDAs, and chambers from throughout greater Minnesota. You'll see our 10-point legislative agenda, of which broadband is one of them, in fact, the number one issue, and I'll tell you why in a second. Next page talks about why I have an advocacy group interested in greater Minnesota. And I think one of the key points there and why we're here is this is important for economic development. And one of the bond rating agencies the state uses is Moody's. And in 2013, in one of their analytical statements, they came out and they are very concerned about the divergence in the economy in the non-metropolitan area in Minnesota, as are we. And so we think that it's time to take some action to improve the economy throughout the state. Next, you'll see a membership map, which gives an idea where our members are from. They're from all over the state. We're now at 70 members and growing. Those members are listed on the next page. The reason that broadband, Mr. Chair and members, is our number one issue, if you look at kind of a chart that looks like this, we conducted over 11 regional meetings late last year and early this year, trying to gauge what was important to community leaders, business leaders, chambers of commerce, that type of thing, and greater Minnesota elected officials. After that, we conducted a survey to see if we had heard correctly. From that survey, the number one issue was broadband and the expansion of broadband and the importance of it in for economic development. That was the number one issue that identified. And it really may not have been the number one in every regional meeting, but it was always in the top one or two. So it is an important issue for us. On the back page of it, you'll see how we arrived at that. And you'll see the snappy map here of the state of Minnesota. I've got the larger version here on my left. And people define broadband differently, but in this case, using the Connect Minnesota information, we're defining it as 25 megabit download speed and 6 megabit upload speed. The unshaded areas, or the white areas, would be parts of the state where at least 50% of the households have availability of internet at that speed. And then the darker the shading, the less you have. And so clearly you can see that there are parts of the state that are very much underserved. There's a handout that talks then about why we got interested in this and the broadband coverage, again, the disparities of it. And I won't go through it, but a couple of main points. What we're doing is patterning this infrastructure fund after what's happened in the state of New York. State of New York has invested, I believe they're actually over $60 million now in a similar fund, and yet they were already in the top 10. And if you, I was chatting with somebody on the way over, if you look in statute, you'll find that Minnesota has some goals for broadband adoption that, frankly, we're not going to meet. And so that's why we think we have to be bolder than New York, because they were already in the top 10. We're at 23rd, I think, as a Minnesotan. I just don't like that, you know. We have a goal in statute to be number 5 by 2015. We're not going to make that goal. But it's time that we start or stop talking about it and actually do something to achieve that goal. On the back side of that page talks about the GDP impact of it. If this map, instead of having shaded areas, was all white, according to the Strategic Networks Group, that would have an impact of $1 billion in additional growth in the state of Minnesota each and every year. So it's an important economic issue for the entire state of Minnesota. The next page, members and Mr. Chair, is broadband availability by county. It's a little bit different way of looking at this, but it's got your alphabetical listing of counties, number of households, the number of households that are connected at that speed, and then the percentage. And, you know, I've heard from a lot of people, and in fact, I think at one time I'd have put myself in that same camp as saying, gee, things are fine, everything's great, we don't need to do anything else, keep government out of this. But if you look at that percentage, you'll start to see that there is a problem. There are some parts of our state, some counties in our state, where you've got 0.0, and you've got others, not all in the metropolitan area. There are some counties in greater Minnesota that have reasonable coverage, but by and large, most of the counties in greater Minnesota are underserved. And as our businesses try to create jobs, and we must compete, whether that's competition against South Dakota or South Korea. As Gary mentioned, we're not only behind other states, we're behind other countries. This is an increasingly important item. So take a look at that chart, and even if it's not your county, I mean, I think it really does a pretty good job of highlighting what the problem is. And then the last document is a copy of a opinion piece that was penned by former Speaker Kelleher and myself, and I think she will testify next. We wanted you to have that as well. But we think this is, and our members think, our board believes that this is the number one issue, the thing that we should do in order to see economic development growth. Obviously, we have the resources currently to do it. If we don't do it now, I guess the question would be, when will we ever do it? Or maybe we didn't mean those goals when we put them in statute. I think we did, and I think it's time to do something.
Very good. That's a lot of good information. I appreciate you bringing it forward. And we'll move on to our next testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And
you want to ask it now? Otherwise, can I ask? Sure. Go ahead. Representative Benson wants to... ask the question right now. That's
thank
great.
You. And this question, I guess, is for Mr. Evans. You cited a lot of accolades in terms of what you were able to accomplish in Winona County. I'm from Olmsted County. How much public money did you get to do that?
We didn't get any. We
that's
sought...
Mr. Evans.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson. We applied for a stimulus grant. We didn't receive it. We have used our own money to build the networks, but if we had access to a fund like this, we'd be able to respond more clearly to some of the opportunities that exist in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, thank you. I appreciate that, but you've got accolades all the way to the White House, and you didn't expend any public money. And I just want that members be mindful of the fact that there's $100 million in this bill. And I hope we don't become as economically disadvantaged as New York, by the way, who stuck $60 million into this. I hope that Minnesota's economy is already doing better without public money and a broadband fund. To just give you an idea, $100 million, that's 25% more money than the governor's got in the bonding bill for local bridges and roads. So please be mindful as we discuss these things. First of all, we've been able to accomplish an awful lot without getting deeply into debt or with public money. And the way this technology changes, and I think we'll probably hear from more folks about this, we might as well, in this bill, to me at least, there's nothing tied to how the money's going to be spent in terms of what the real need is. And shoot, we might as well just ask for a billion. So it's a big number, and for me, for one, I'm very cognizant of all the taxes that we've raised over the last couple of years and how we're going to spend money. No doubt that there would be a lot of people who would like to have faster internet speed, but I want to make sure that the taxpayers' dollars are spent in a wise fashion. And you've already said, and I think this is in the purview of business. And providing these services now that we're going to get heads down into it in public, using public money, I think we need a lot of discussion.
Members, forgive us, hold off then questions until we finish with testifiers. Is that okay with you, Representative Uglem? We'll just move through the testifiers and get a chance. I'm sure the testifiers are going to stick around and be able to answer any questions. Welcome, Margaret Anderson Kelleher.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for having me before you again, this time specifically to talk about this fund bill. And I appreciate your concern, but I think I'm going to help you see in the context of the Governor's Broadband Task Force, which has membership on it from industry, a significant membership from industry, significant membership from the nonprofit community, and significant representation from the counties and cities as well. And so the report that we issued early this year, and I know many of you actually have taken a look at this report because you've emailed me. You can download it off the Connect Minnesota website or the Department of Commerce website, still under the broadband tab. It has the legislative recommendations, and I want to compliment Representative Simonson on bringing forward this portion of the legislative recommendations. I see many champions of other portions of the legislative recommendations around the table, particularly the sales tax issue as well. And so I want to thank you for that. We think that in our study of the issue over the past 3 years, that to be able to make the state statutory broadband goals by 2015, we are going to be short, but we can make a difference this year with wise investment of making sure there is a matching fund available to reach the over 500,000 Minnesotans who are underserved and unserved by broadband today, actually unserved by broadband today. So that's not just about a faster speed, Mr. Chairman. That is about the people in the state who can't connect at a speed that we would find anywhere near acceptable. For those students who come home and are assigned by their teacher to watch a video about AP US history and they have to summarize it and come in the next day ready for discussion, when they go home, and if they live in Pine County, it is very unlikely they are even connected to the internet, as the task force heard this year. Why a grant or loan fund, and why did the task force recommend this? It's because those dollars that you might invest, one-time dollars, no tails, this is not a situation where you have to worry about the out years of expenditure on these particular monies, can be partnered with private dollars, can be partnered with private dollars from providers, philanthropic donations, which I think was an important part of the Winona County project, actually. I'm sure if Mr. Evans were up here again, he'd say they got a significant philanthropic donation to begin that project. It wasn't public money, but it was money from the outside. We believe that with the correct structure of this fund, much like the Minnesota Investment Fund or other funds that the Department of Employment and Economic Development currently runs, that we could leverage these dollars 3, 4, maybe even 5 times. And although you all know there can be major battles between private providers and public entities, and we know there's a lot of detail to work out, I want to tell you that we all support creating a fund. Whether it's the private sector or the public sector right now, we think a fund is a wise use of these dollars to connect those 500,000 Minnesotans. I want to just say a couple other things of why. You know the numbers. You know kind of what students face, what healthcare faces in the state. You heard a little bit about the economic potential of growth and what can happen. That's on top of the great growth that we have already. But the other part of it that I think is important is to understand, well, why is it even needed? And it's needed because, for the most part, when you are less than a mile out of a city limit, it costs about $3,500 to connect a home to the speeds that we're talking about in the state statute. And we think that most providers are fairly responsive to that. But when you go up beyond a mile, and I know that, you know, Representative Metzen knows a lot about this, he's got a big territory, you can escalate very quickly, $10,000, $15,000 to connect. The fact of the matter is, private providers, even working with a local unit, a township, a county, cannot seem to make that work as well as they would like to. The return on investment just is not there, and that is why these one-time investments are just like the investments that were made years ago. Roads, electricity across the state, being able to have this important service. It increases the level of home businesses, the level of education, the level of healthcare connection, and we strongly, strongly recommend, as the Governor's Broadband Task Force, that you work hard to take and use a wise investment to help all Minnesotans. And again, Mr. Chairman, thank you for your interest in the issue. Representative Simonson, thank you for your leadership on the issue, and I'll stick around if there are questions later.
I appreciate you sticking around, because I think there will be questions.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I know we have several people from Annandale. If you'd all come down who are from Annandale to the table. Is this all the Annandale people now? Three? Okay. Excuse me. If you want to go ahead and identify yourself for the record and take a few minutes to give your presentation, that'd be great. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Shelley Jonas. I am a city councilor in the city of Annandale.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kelly Hinnenkamp. I am the city administrator for the city of Annandale.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Deb Reitmeyer. I am the administrator and president of Annandale Health and Community Services in Annandale.
Nice to have you here. Go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, thank you for taking the time today to talk about this issue. It's a very pervasive issue in our community. And I realized 2 days ago just how much when I was at a funeral and an 80-year-old nun approached me and said, "What are we going to do about this broadband situation?" So that was kind of a wake-up call to show us how much it affects everybody in our community. Annandale is located in Wright County, just about an hour west of here. Over the past 2 years, increased internet demand and combined with the lack of investment by the internet provider has created a dire situation for our community. Annandale has a single provider and a decaying system, and that has resulted in unreliable service, slow speeds, and frequent outages, sometimes for multiple days. During these outages or latencies, our businesses cannot process credit cards, and often some of our community members won't even come to these businesses anymore because they're afraid that the businesses might write down their credit card number for when the internet comes back. So there's a loss of business. Our medical facilities cannot access patient records, and prescriptions cannot be filled. They talked a little bit earlier about students. I've heard families that will drive 20, 30 miles so that their students can access online learning. The businesses cannot use web-based technologies that increase efficiencies. This leaves our community far behind the expectations of the 21st century. Many businesses need the internet to do business with state, to pay their sales tax, to sell fishing licenses, to sell license plates. They need that connection, and when it's out, they can't do that, transact that business. This just affects the quality of our life overall. Although it's not really about iTunes, one of my residents told me recently that it took 167 minutes to download a song. That's the kind of speed that we're dealing with. And if you've done that before, you know that that should be a two-second process. With nowhere to turn, the Annandale community has turned to the city for a solution. Efforts have been made to work with the incumbent provider, but unfortunately, there is no incentive for them to upgrade their system or hold them accountable for the packages that they're selling. With the assistance of the Blandon Foundation, the city commissioned a study in 2013 to identify a solution to improve service in Annandale. The goal of this study was to identify potential partners, both public and private, and develop various models to deploy a broadband network that will meet the needs of the future of Annandale. The city has determined the following findings as a result of this study. 34% of our survey respondents telecommute for work. 21% have a home-based business requiring the internet. The survey data provided a strong argument for a new provider and supports findings that broadband in Annandale is significantly poor. Over 95% of our respondents said that they would be likely to change internet service and would support the city's involvement. The challenges that we face is that we have one shot at this. If our potential partner does not install technology that is future-proof, we could be sitting in the exact same situation in 5 to 10 years. Furthermore, we have a lot of density around our area lakes. If those extended areas are not built out, our local economy will suffer because those people make an important part of it. It also is a significant portion of our school district.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the impact of this bill is
this
very
is
Hinnenkamp?
Yes, I'm Kelly Hinnenkamp, City Administrator. The impact of this bill is significant for Annandale and small communities across the state for three primary reasons. First, the bill levels the playing field in obtaining high-quality broadband at an affordable price. The fund will offset the burden small communities have with the economies of scale and ensure that the cost of doing business in our community is comparable to the cost of doing business in densely populated areas. Second, the fund will create a level of accountability to the incumbent providers. Without the likelihood of municipal networks, small markets will likely never see improvements to their broadband infrastructure, even if the investment could be offset by state funds. Improvements will go in areas where stronger business models exist and not where the community need is. Third, the ability for local governments to access these funds will allow small communities like Annandale to be in control of our future. We recognize that our future is dependent upon broadband. It's a part of how we live, how our businesses operate, how we educate our students, how we provide health care to our residents. This utility has become essential to the quality of life we have in Annandale, and we feel the local leaders should be given the opportunity to make the decisions that are right for our community. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Reitmeyer, did you want to say something?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Annandale Health and Community Services is a senior living campus. We have a nursing home, assisted living, memory care, wellness center. We're the health care provider in our community for our seniors. We are not any different from all of the other healthcare providers in this state, where they are being mandated by January 1st, 2015 to have fully functional electronic health records in place. What that electronic health record is meant to do is so that when you go to the doctor and you had a test in one clinic or an x-ray at a diagnostic imaging place, your clinic can electronically, using broadband, pull those records. The days of carrying your records in an envelope with you from provider to provider are over. And that is what that mandate is largely responsible for making us all do. Nursing homes are not required in that mandate, but clinics and hospitals are. They are already working with us as nursing homes because we do a lot of transferring of records. We have seniors going back and forth to the hospital almost on a daily basis. We are constantly admitting people for short-term rehab stays. All of those records, come January 1st, need to travel broadband. We in Annandale, we do not have the speeds to even be able to achieve that. We will be left behind. And other nursing homes and other providers in rural communities will also be left behind. These laws have been made, but we do not have the tools to comply with the laws. And so I think that's unfair. We use this broadband on a daily basis in our facility. Sales tax. We file our sales tax. We do our 990s. We do our cost reports. We file claims. Claims must be filed electronically. We have no choice. There's no paper allowed. So what do we do when we are trying to file claims to get paid and we have no broadband service? And it does go out for anywhere from 24 to 48 hours. We also have our electronic health record. When we go down, we're in the middle of a med pass. Nurses are standing there with a screen. This resident needs a med. The screen, we have no access. Now what do? We run to another machine that we have on a backup system, print out 800 pages of paper, and switch to a paper system for our med pass. That's unacceptable. It's unacceptable to our residents. It's unacceptable to Minnesota. We're supposed to be taking care of our seniors, and we're not. They shouldn't have to wait for their meds. The challenges for us are the speed and the provider we have. We have one provider. I have been trying to get them to return a call for 2 weeks. Working on speed, actually have gone to the next step. Tell me how much more I have to pay to get better speed. We need this. Still can't get a phone call back. They're not interested in doing anything for us in our community. There's no money in it. There's not enough homes. There's not enough businesses to make investment worth it for them. So in answer to Representative Benson, what are we supposed to do? Yes, public money, but we're sitting in our community and other rural communities, and the providers won't do anything, what are we supposed to do? Where are we supposed to churn?
Well, we'll take that as a rhetorical question for now, and I do want to give
Chair.
members opportunity to ask questions a little later, but I think we have one person. Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate you coming from Andale to share your stories and information. That's very helpful. We have Abby Biduck, I think, wanted to testify. And who else wants to testify? Got a couple there. Okay. And again, we want to make it the testifiers, if you can make it kind of tight and to the point so we give opportunity for members to weigh in, that'd be great. Welcome. So if you can make your testimony kind of brief and to the point, that'd be great.
I'm happy to do that. I'll make it snappy. My name is Abby Biduck. I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties, and I just want to let the committee know that this is one of our priorities currently that we're sort of drumming up through our ranks. It was mentioned that broadband is kind of right now experiencing a buzz across the state, and that's absolutely true within our organization. And not because it's the new exciting thing, because people are realizing how important this is, especially to rural areas. And so, you know, counties aren't looking for new industries to get into, new businesses just to begin. We have quite enough to deal with as we stand, and especially in light of, you know, the last recent years of efficiencies and those sorts of movements going on. But we have a real need out there, and our residents are asking for help. In fact, my position at the Association of Minnesota Counties is primarily transportation, but we recently added broadband to the infrastructure sort of department because we see this almost as important, and especially for rural Minnesota, as roads and bridges. This is basic infrastructure. This is the same arguments we need these roads. We need internet access for entertainment. It's for commerce. It's for all the things you heard about today. But so we are very keen to find ways to try to help serve our constituents, and we think this is an excellent program. I'll just make one more point about the Blandin group has done some excellent studies on return on investment, and it's just incredible when you look at the increases in revenue, not only for county revenue, city rate, but state revenues. In the increased amounts of commerce and business that can happen with increased adoption and usage. And so, you know, that merits a state investment as far as we're concerned, because this will really be a return for, you know, private citizens, all level of governments. It's really a wise way to spend our dollars. So I just wanted to throw out that encouragement out there, and thank you very much for looking.
Thank you for your testimony. We have two testifiers. Why don't you both come on up and have a seat at the chair and kind of alternate there. And if there's anybody else right now, I don't see anybody else. Okay. Go ahead and identify yourself for the record and say what you want to say.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Tony Mendoza. I'm outside counsel to the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. From Comcast here in the Twin Cities area to Mid-Continent Cable serving the Ely area to tiny little Schoberg's Cable and Thief River Falls, the cable industry is the leading sector of this industry in terms of bringing broadband to the state of Minnesota. First, I want to be clear. We are members of the Broadband Task Force. We have a representative on that task force, and we support the concept of creating a broadband fund. However, we do not support the bill in its current form. We think the funds for that fund should be targeted at the areas that truly don't have broadband service at this time. We had asked for an amendment to the bill that would define where this money can go to areas that have nothing right now. And there are a lot of areas of the state. I believe some of you may have a map that we provided to that shows exactly where the truly unserved areas of the state are right now. If you can't, I don't know if it's been passed out or not, but
no, we have it. Thank you.
You've got it. This is a map created by the Federal Communications Commission as part of a new experimental program to help subsidize areas of the country that have that don't meet the FCC's definition of broadband, which is 4 megabits upload or download and 1 megabit upload. The areas that are green on that Minnesota map are truly unserved areas. And you can see there's quite a bit of territory within the state of Minnesota that has no service whatsoever. This $100 million for this fund will, in our view, should go first to those areas that have nothing at all. And that's the amendment that essentially we proposed be made to this amendment. It stays true to the spirit of bringing broadband to the truly unserved. It moves the needle forward in terms of the state's broadband goals because no provider that would use this money to invest in the state of Minnesota is going to deploy a network that doesn't, you know, look toward the future and at least provide speeds that meet the state's broadband goals. So this does move the needle on the state broadband goals. It just targets the subsidies at the areas that don't have anything at this time.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Mendoza. And I assume you're willing to work with Representative Simonson to kind of get closer to where you think, anyway, makes sense.
Mr. Chair, we absolutely are, yes.
Mr. Christensen, welcome. We want to identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Brent Christensen, and I'm the President and CEO of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance. We're a trade association that represents 46 independent providers throughout the state. I, too, support the concept of the fund. I think that's I applaud the task force for their bold recommendation and the direction they're going. And like Mr. Mendoza, I believe that it has to be for truly unserved areas. And unserved means no service. Numbers can be moved. They can be changed to fit whatever story needs to be told. The map there that is used is using 25 meg down, 6 meg upload speeds. That's not the state goal. So if you move this closer to the state goal is 10 to 20 up, 5 to 10 up, 10 to 20 down. And if you use that standard, as Mrs. Anderson Kelleher said, 532,000 homes don't have access. It's about 74%, 74.5% of the state has access to speeds at that goal. If you move that upload speed to 3 megabits upload, then that moves the needle immensely. That only means 23,000 people, homes in this state doesn't have access, and that moves the tier to 98.91% of the state has access at that speed. So that means that we've met the download speed, and we're 2 megabits per second on the upload speed. Now, I'm not saying the job is done. It's not. We have work to do, but we're a lot closer than people think. We've got to get the upload speed, and I don't know about you. I don't know the difference between 3 megabits up and 5 megabits up. I've installed DSL my whole life, or since it's been around, and I don't know what that difference is. So that's what we need to be focused on. There are parts of the state that truly don't have access to it. The story that the previous testifiers did about Annandale is actually sadder than they said, because for many years, Annandale was a leader in telecommunications in the state. They were a family-owned company, Lakedale Communications, and they sold to an out-of-state provider that has no presence in the state. So I believe everything that they're saying. But the fact of the matter is they've got three providers that are willing to come in and build them a network that will be operational by the end of the summer and get the things that they need. Now, it's the difference between whether they're going to drive a Chevy at no cost to the state or we're going to give them a Cadillac. Now, having installed broadband and built up a network myself, I will tell you that the way to do that is to start off with customers. And then you use the revenue from those customers to deploy the network, to keep it going, and eventually you end up with an all-fiber network, because that's where the industry is going. But if they can get what they need today with the network that's built today and grow that customer base, which I don't think they'll have any problem given their competition, then they can get to where they need to go. And they can do it without having to do money from this fund. There are parts in the state where it is just too expensive to build and install the fiber or install anything into those areas. Representative Falk comes to mind. I've talked with him many times about he just can't get broadband at all. This fund needs to be for people like him, and they need to be for other people in the state that just can't get it. I'm an advocate that says that I believe that everybody should get on the information highway. There shouldn't be haves or have-nots. And unfortunately, in the current form of this bill, we're going to create a greater digital divide. I think we need to have a little bit of a reality check. I think we need to take a step back and focus on truly getting to the unserved. I appreciate Representative Simonson's leadership on this, and we look forward to being able to work with him to get this to where it needs to go.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. We're going to, at this point, move to questions and comments from committee members. We'll start with Representative Buechlin.
Thank you. I guess I'll address my question to Representative Simonson as long as he's sitting there. I do support broadband, and I think it's a very, very important part for our outstate business community and everything else. My question and my problem with this is a matter of priorities throughout the state. This is a $100 million request. I guess we're spending the so-called surplus as fast as we can here. You know, we have many other priorities within the state, too, and the Greater Minnesota Business Partnership Survey showed that, for instance, transportation is one of a key goal for them, too, and I think it is for all of us. My question, Representative, is just, I mean, $100 million at this point in time. New York is spending $60 million. In view of priorities, do you feel this $100 million is maybe a little bit too much, and we could direct some money to other priorities within the state?
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Uglum. You know, that's a great question, and I don't want to get into the weeds on a finance discussion here in front of this committee, but I will tell you this, that I certainly support the $100 million investment. And I think if you read the Broadband Task Force report, it talks about the actual need and the actual cost and the actual amount of dollars that we, in theory, could invest in Minnesota. But to me, it comes down to, and I think Representative Benson made this point too, and the one thing that I will agree with him on is that we need to be aware of and smart about how we invest taxpayer dollars. And I do agree with that. But I think this is one particular area where if you invest $100 million, it's going to return itself many, many times over in many different industries in many different ways, and it will pay back the state. So when we get to the Finance Committee, we'll talk about, you know, the size of that investment and the value of that investment. But frankly, yes, I do support it.
Mr. Chair, just one quick follow-up. You know, I think we need to put this in perspective, this tremendous cost here. And, you know, I said on jobs, and MIF, the entire program, and the Angel Investment Tax Credit Program, which are very important for businesses, don't even approach this $100 million. So it's a good cause. I just think we're a little over the top on the amount. Thank you.
Very good. Representative Hoppe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Simonson, I, like Representative Uglum, and I think probably all of us, like the idea and like the goal. Representative Johnson and I and others have been working on telecom and cable and broadband issues for years. And I would caution you, work with those two gentlemen up there. If everybody is more or less a piece in the valley and headed in the same direction, it will make it a lot easier. It's always been a, I don't know, what would you say, nonpartisan, bipartisan issue. And it is critical for the Minnesota's future and our development. We just have to figure out how to pay for it and how to do it. And I got just a couple of quick questions. Representative Simonson, where's the money coming from, the $100 million? And then I kind of a follow-up, same thing. What about the telecom tax that's in right now that's on the capital equipment for all of the companies?
Very good. Representative Simonson?
Representative Johnson. And committee members. So there are two questions there. Let me just say that the $100 million that we're talking about in this bill would be one-time monies would anticipate come from the surplus. Just be straight up front about that.
Okay.
As far as the telecom tax, now that provision is contained in the House tax bill, I'm sure, as you know, which we'll be debating later today. But if that bill were to pass in its present form, essentially there would be $12.3 million, I think, left over. That is intended to go, at least in concept at this point, because the bill has not been passed, that is intended to go into this program. So that would be $12.3 million in sales tax that the state has collected already. And as you know, we're repealing in that bill, we'd be repealing that tax going forward. But the money's collected, it was agreed in the tax committee that they should be reinvested back into the industry through this program.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Hoppe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Simonson. And I like that reinvesting, and I like the idea that we're not having this tax on the companies going forward, because that just gives them more money to invest. And I'm very sympathetic to Annandale, and Lakedale going away was not good. And I will give you one caution. And 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, we were talking about municipal Wi-Fi. Every city in the state wanted to do municipal Wi-Fi. I do a fair amount of reading about this, and I believe there's one city in the whole United States ever that made Wi-Fi work, and that's where I live, in Chaska. And they did it because they own their own utility, and they didn't have to pay for pole rental. A lot of the employees were doing utility work and Wi-Fi work, you know, and you can say it's an accounting issue, whatever it is, but it's, we need to be careful as we make these investments that we're not doing things that are going to cause the city of Annandale or counties or other municipalities more money down the road. And with that, I wish you good luck with this, and I hope that you work with Mr. Christensen and others and get our elusive peace in the valley. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. From the testifiers, I guess what I heard was that essentially you would like for the state to pay for the last mile on the hardest areas of the state to reach. I'm kind of wondering then, does the state then reap the benefit from the payers? I mean, a big part of your costs are your infrastructure and the amount of money that you have to invest, whether it be, just anything that you have to invest. What you're asking for is money from the state to get to that last mile on the hardest reach. What's the state's, the taxpayers' cut on when we do that?
Mr. Christensen?
Mr. Chairman, Representative
briefly.
Benson, we kind of look at this as a lot of the same goals as the Rural Electrification Act back in the 30s, where we think that everybody's broadband has more value if everybody has broadband. And there just isn't any economic way that you can overcome the hurdle of installation at some of those places. So if we could create a grant program where those people could apply to that, and come up with, we actually have some other suggestions of other tools that we can do to help the consumer overcome that burden. But from an economic development standpoint, we agree with everybody that broadband is important. Is there a cash return on investment? No, sir.
Follow up.
Last follow up.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm really having a hard time with it, I guess you can tell. Not that I don't appreciate the need for broadband. I'll just leave it with this. I'll work with the author on the Affordable Cable Act, and we'll create a $160 million internet, and we'll see how the government does with that. I mean, it's, folks, we could get into everything as a state, and I think this is one of those where the technology is racing ahead, and here we're going to invest $100 million, and in 20 years, this could all be for naught. I'll stop there.
Very good. Well, but two last comments, and we're going to move to the vote. We'll start with Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hoppe hit on a number of mine, and so in the interest of time, I just want to underscore that this afternoon, as Representative Simonson said, we're going to be debating a tax bill that's going to repeal some very onerous tax bills that were put on hardworking folks here in the state of Minnesota last year, and we're racing really hard at the start of this race to repeal those, and I'm pleased with that. But $100 million would leave about, after the tax bill and we're giving folks their money back, about $800 million, so you're asking for about one-eighth of that money for this project. That's an awful big ask, I think, so I just want members to think about the size of this. I think the goal is lofty, is laudable, but the amount of money that we're looking at, I really don't know if the state is going to make that a top priority over other things that have already been fiscally before committees. I think we've already spent that $800 million at least once, if not twice already, in the little more than a week that we've been back in session. So,
thank you, Representative Jessica. Lastly, Representative Metzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do share some of the same concerns that have been mentioned. I just wanted to point out a few things. Monticello right now, who's done this, is 10 cents on the dollar for selling their bonds currently. And I do believe that the intent of this bill has it's a great intent, and I support the author moving it out of committee today. Let me clarify that before I go further here. Lake County, also some concern. I would be interested if Lake County has a return on investment plan and can actually compete as a business against other businesses who share market share, and if they would be applying for more money after already securing over $60 million in loans from the federal government through the RUS program. And looking at this, I do agree with the statements about the map, too. We are talking about a big difference between the 25 megabyte. For example, I pay for the highest speed I can get in my town, Virginia, and it's at 7. Overall, there are some other concerns I have in this, just in the definition of unserved. Does it conform with federal language, and if we don't have that language matching, would it exclude us from accessing any federal funds potentially in the future?
Is that Cressman, Representative
Metzger? Yeah, I'll have a few follow-ups too, Mr. Chair.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm
Margaret Anderson Keller.
I'm here to help, but not totally, because I think that some of your detailed questions are exactly why the task force in their recommendations did not work out every detail of what you should do. You definitely need to have a policy direction on the dollars. But I want to be very clear. This fund is a fund that is open to everyone. It's a fund that's open to private companies as well as potentially pairing public entities together with them. So when we hear words like Monticello, which tend to be a trigger word for a lot of people in the telecom industry in Minnesota, that's not what we're talking about in this bill. We're actually talking about giving more points potentially with how you decide and how DEED decides to do this to partnership agreements between publics and privates, because the task force has a pretty strong perspective that to get there, you need that. So I want to be really clear that this is not an all public bill. This is about making sure that Minnesotans get more broadband. The 500,000 Minnesotans who are not connected at the state speed goal, and that is the law. That's the goal we're working on here. And so I also want to be clear about that. I think that Dana McKenzie's in the audience. I don't know if she's prepared to answer that question today about how that would line us up for federal dollars, because that is, Representative Metzger, Mr. Chair, it's one of our ideas here, is that a good fund partnered with the federal dollars that the FCC is working on right now, that then private dollars as well. That's where we get that 3 to 4 times the investment. The other thing I just want to say is that people might be wondering about what is the cost to reach all Minnesotans. So in our estimate, using Ellert & Associates in a 2012 report, to provide broadband to every Minnesotan at the state speed goals would cost between $900 million and $3.2 billion. At $100 million, which would be wonderful. However, I'm a realist about this too. I mean, I'd take your $60 million from the state of New York right now if you're offering that, Representative Benson. But if we were to do that, we are only going to reach 3% of those people at that straight $100 million. So just to put it in context.
Representative Messett, final question?
Yeah, I'll be quick here. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a follow-up to that, open to everyone, is actually one of my concerns. We've got cities of the first class who don't meet these requirements with the broadband goals that you outlined that would have access to money, more staff, and more people who can actually take the time to write grants that would put my communities at a disadvantage and my townships. And I have a lot of townships in my district that just wouldn't be able to get through that process because of that. And I'd hope that as we move forward, and again, Representative Simonson has been very gracious to agree to work with this and has already agreed to set up a meeting with all the stakeholders in making sure that these priorities are for the truly unserved first.
Very good. And I know working with Representative Simonson, he's very willing to work with all members of the committee and to do the best job we can in making a bill that works for Minnesota. Representative Simonson, your last comments?
Very briefly, Mr. Chair. Let me just leave you with this. One thing that I heard today is that no one in this room, advocate or opponent, is opposed to access to broadband, which I take as a very good sign. which I take as a sign that we move forward and we come up with something that works good on behalf of Minnesota. As Representative Metza has said, I am 100% committed to meeting with all of the stakeholders prior to our next committee stop and trying to resolve as many of the concerns as we possibly can. There's no question about that. And lastly, Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask members of the committee to support this as we move forward, because I do think it's the right investment for Minnesota. But I would just encourage you to please take the time to read Subdivision 6 of the bill, which talks about the awarding of the grants, and it talks about a lot of the priorities that will be given to applications. And I think that particular section will answer and address a lot of the questions. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would just encourage your support.
Thank you. With that, Representative Simonson renews this motion that House File 2615, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs and Economic Development, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Sure. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. On to the next stop. Representative Simonson, get to work with all these people. With that, folks, the meeting is adjourned.